Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Leah.
Guess why we're here today?
Is it because we're taking a vacation from the Middle Ages and moving a little bit forward in history to something that most people only remember from history courses they took in school?
Okay, you stole my thunder a little bit, but basically, yes, that's why we're here. Who are we talking to?
So today we're talking to Professor Richard White of Stanford University, and we're talking about the American Civil War, Reconstruction, and the Gilded Age.
Now, I know we have a bunch of smarty pants who listen to the show, but for the peasants like me, can you give me a refresher on what's happening in America at that time?
Okay, well, so this is a fascinating period of history, and it's one that doesn't get talked about very much. It usually gets glossed straight over. What we have is, beginning with the Civil War, the bloodiest conflict in American history, and one that still reverberates today, was followed by Reconstruction, which was the process by which the South was brought back into the United States, with a whole bunch of long-term implications for the treatment of African Americans, for how political power functioned in the South, and for the relationship between the various parts of the country. This was really important. At the same time, we have westward expansion. We have the building of the transcontinental railroads. We have mass immigration from Europe. We have mass industrialization taking place, the full rise of industrial capitalism across the country. There was a lot happening. There was a very great deal happening, and all of it was happening amid the greatest political corruption the United States had ever seen or would ever see.
I know when I'm searching like the gaps in my brain from American history, there's a huge kind of black hole between the Civil War and then the turn of the century, 1900s. I feel like there's clear, like I remember the stuff that happened around the 60s, maybe very getting into the 1870s. I know what happened in the early 1900s, but there's a huge gap. Why can't I remember anything that happened?
That's because it's not a story that Americans want to focus on overmuch as part of their history. Reconstruction was a failure. Reconstruction did not do what it was supposed to do. And Reconstruction went down the way it did because of very specific series of failures within the American political system and the American party system. This was a time of massive corruption, and we tend to think of corruption as something that is not good in governance. It was a time of effectively genocide committed against Native Americans, mass seizures of land, expropriation, of serious labor unrest, of declining living standards for a lot of people. This is not a happy period of time. And if you want to tell the story of America as one where things get better over time, where, you know, the Civil War was a valiant conflict fought to free the slaves, and after that, you know, well, things got good. Well, no, the Gilded Age, Reconstruction, this is when we get the explicit imposition of Jim Crow laws. So it's not like there is a steady upward swing where things get better. And if that's the story of America that you're interested in telling, this period is really awkward and inconvenient for you. So I think it gets glossed over.
And why are we talking to Richard White about these things now? How does it relate to the tides that we know?
Because I think the book that he wrote on this period, The Republic for Which It Stands, I think is one of the best and most relevant history books I've read in a very long time. I think the echoes of our own times in a whole bunch of different ways are too obvious to miss. Like, you don't need to hammer yourselves over the head with them. But, you know, like Mark Twain said, history may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And I think if you read that book, if you spend some time with this period, you're going to see those rhymes come out pretty clearly. I thought it was a delightful book, really excellent book, one that a lot of people would find interesting. And also, I think he's a great historian. I think he's one of the greatest living historians of the United States. His book, Railroaded, which was all about the transcontinentals and basically how political corruption was essential to the process of those getting made and being profitable. I thought that was one of the better books I've ever read. So he's somebody that I've wanted to talk to for a long time. I thought the topic was perfect. And, you know, it's nice to mix things up. It's nice to get out of our little medieval and early modern wheelhouse every now and again.
Okay, final question for you. Spoiler for the interview, Richard uses the word recalcitrant. I would like to hereby nominate it to replace feckless.
But we get so much use out of feckless. We will use recalcitrant, don't get me wrong. That's actually a word that I use fairly regularly in my own daily life, but I will try and work it into scripts more. I'm not giving up feckless, though. I will hang on to feckless like the raft from the Titanic.
Spoken like the true feckless peasant that you are. All right, here's our conversation with Richard White.
Hello, my peasant friends. It's Patrick. I have some really exciting news. You can now listen to our back catalog completely ad-free, exclusively on Stitcher Premium. Plus, you can listen to every new episode ad-free, too. You can sign up now for a free month of Stitcher Premium by going to stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and using the promo code Wondery. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. Thanks for joining me. We've got a fantastic guest in the studio here today. He is the Margaret Byrne Professor of History at Stanford University and the author of several books, the most recent of which is the latest entry in the Oxford History of the United States series. It's called The Republic for Which It Stands, and it covers Reconstruction and the Gilded Age from 1865 to 1896. It's also one of the very best books I've read in the past few years, and I highly recommend it to you. Richard White, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Patrick.
I want to start off with a quote from the introduction of The Republic for Which It Stands, which I think kind of encapsulates the book's argument and viewpoint. So, historians once embraced corruption as diagnostic of the age, but for the past half century, they have downplayed its importance. They have been wrong to do so. The Gilded Age was corrupt, and corruption in government and business mattered. Corruption suffused government and the economy. So, what do you mean here by corruption, and how did it matter?
What I mean by corruption is the ability to take public monies and public purposes and twist them into private profit. So that one of the things that happens in the Gilded Age is that much of the government goes out on contract. It becomes what historians call fee-based governance, that you paid for services. And what this allowed private entities to do is to gain subsidies, to take on what are government powers and use them for private purposes, to funnel away public monies that were supposed to go for the public good and turn them into private profits. And this became not a few people, but it became pervasive. It became pervasive at virtually every level of government. And the real damage it does, of course, is that over time, it means that the public begins to lose faith in government, particularly at a time where they realize they need government more than ever.
So was it just a given that people understood this corruption? I mean, how did they feel about it? Was it just a given that your congressman was going to be taking bribes from everybody and you were okay with that? Or were there movements against it in this period?
There are movements against it, and it's more complicated than just bribes. I mean, there's a Gilded Age word that's called friendship. It took me a while to figure out what they mean by friendship. And for people to be friends is they look out for each other's interests. So a congressman would not have to actually take a bribe to help, let's say, a Transcontinental Railroad Corporation. They would know that they would be taken care of. They would be given a job after they got out of Congress. They'd be given useful financial information, which they could use on the stock and bond markets. They might even be written in under a pseudonym, be given railroad land, part of a land grant. All of these things are not quid pro quo. The whole idea of friendship is you don't need quid pro quo. People understand their interests. And if you have to bribe somebody, the system is actually breaking down. It's this everybody has their hand in each other's pocket.
That's such a fascinating way of approaching it. I mean, when you talk about friendship, it's a word we think we understand what friendship means, but the kind of cluster of meanings that it takes on in this particular context is so much more pervasive.
Yeah, and it is. It puzzled me at first because I'd read essentially a lot of history is just reading other people's mail. And so I knew these guys hated each other. They despised each other. But the letters would say, friend Huntington, friend Stanford. And I began to realize that they mean something by friend that I don't mean. There's no affection involved in this. This is a set of mutuality of interests, and that's what friendship was. So it was one of the big breakthroughs for me in writing this and in a previous book that once I began to understand what they mean by friendship, I could begin to understand their worldview, and their actions began to make a lot more sense to me.
The closest parallel I can think of for it is actually the late Roman Republic, where the term amicus, so friend, stood in for the same kind of thing, where it's not like these were your bosom buddies. They were just, these were the dudes that you shared business interests with, and you operated on each other's behalf and in expectation of some kind of return on that investment of time and energy.
Exactly. That's exactly what it means.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating because it gives us an entry point into a world that looks a lot like our own in a lot of ways. And you can draw a lot of parallels from this book. I certainly did as I was reading it. But one where there are some fundamentally different assumptions about the meanings of words, about how things are supposed to work.
Yeah. I mean, it's friendship is one word, home is another word. It's this word which seemed utterly innocuous, but it was everywhere. And again, I began to understand that in the Gilded Age, they began to see the United States not as a collection of individuals, but a collection of homes, and that home has a resonance. We still use the word, but the resonance it had in the 19th century is gone now. And it's one of the keys I found to being a historian is that the hardest things are the words you think you recognize, but their meanings are quite different in a different time.
Yeah, that was absolutely something I was going to ask you about, because I picked out this thing about home, too. And it seems like one of the challenges of writing a book like this is trying to find uniting metaphors and terms and themes that can bind the whole book together. And home was one that you come back to again and again. So why was it so important to people in this period?
Well, it becomes the way that they understand their society, because what the United States is supposed to insist of, it defines gender roles to begin with. There are males and there are men. What men are people who can have a family, be independent, particularly on land or with a business, and then protect that land and home. That is what defines a man. A woman, and there can be females, but a woman is somebody who can maintain order in a home, raise children in a home, and be in charge of the home. So men and women are defined in terms of their fundamental gender roles in terms of the home. They make no sense without it. And so when they talk about men and women, they're not talking about just male and female. They're talking about a particular set of roles. You then begin to understand other people who can be dangerous to the United States. They're threats to the home. And the worst thing that can happen, and it happens largely to minorities and largely to minority men, is to be seen as somebody who does not have a home and threatens the home. And that begins to occur to Chinese. In the late 19th century, it'll occur with black men. And it's not just race, because tramps are a threat to the home. Women who are outside the home, women adrift, as they call them in the 19th century, are a threat to the home. But where you stand in society, what your role is, whether you're a man or a woman, whether you really qualify as a citizen, all of these things are defined around the home.
So how does the understanding of home change depending on context? So say in kind of the expanding West versus in the Reconstruction South versus kind of the filthy and expanding industrial cities of the North, how does it function differently in those contexts?
Now, in each of those places, it's going to be what's happening in society, the social conflicts are defined by the home. And in the South, I'll start with that. The aim of Reconstruction was to give freed people homes. I mean, it's supposed to be, there's a wonderful Thomas Nast cartoon I use in the book, but it shows, in fact, a freed family, mother, father, a grandmother, children, just like a white family sitting in a home. Abraham Lincoln's picture is over the fireplace. And what they're saying is, in effect, the real role of freedom is to have black people have homes just like they imagine white people have. The Ku Klux Klan realizes this too. And one of the reasons why the Klan will attack the home viciously, will in fact drag a man out, beat him in front of his wife and children, sometimes castrate him, sometimes kill him, is the proof is you are not a man. You cannot protect a home. I'm to do the same thing, rapes of black women. You are not a true woman. So these are the kinds of things that the violence is very clearly directed at the home, the capacity of the home. The tenement in the city is going to be the same kind of thing. The problem with the tenement is it's not a real home. Over and over again, you'll see reformers saying these are not homes. These are a travesty on the name of home. And that immigrants cannot maintain homes, so immigrants cannot really be part of the polity. All the symbolism of the West, Buffalo Bill's Wild West, is centered is for a long time on the attack on the settler's cabin, the attack on the wagon train. Indians are people who threaten the white family, threaten the home, and don't really have homes of their own. And over again, this is how Americans will define social conflicts around the home, around conflicts in the West, the East, and the South.
A lot of what you brought up there, it strikes me, these are not particularly happy themes.
No.
This period as a whole is not one that gets like an overwhelming amount of attention in the grand scheme of American history. So why do you think that is? Why do you think this period is not one that gets the kind of attention that the Civil War or the World Wars do?
I find the period intensely interesting, but it's not a happy period, as you say. It does not have a happy ending. What Americans want in their histories is a culmination which is faith promoting. You write a book about the Revolution, we're independent. You write a book about the Civil War, slavery's ended. The Union is reunited. You write a book about World War II, we win the war. You write a book about post-World War II until the present, what you have is the United States rises as a world power and is more prosperous than ever. Gilded Age, none of those things are true. The thing about the Gilded Age is they had a clear aim. They knew what they wanted to achieve at the end of Reconstruction. They wanted a nation that would essentially reproduce Springfield, Illinois, Lincoln's Springfield, a nation of homes in which the whole country would look like the Midwest. Instead, they get an industrial country. They're going to find, instead of a homogeneous population, which they wanted, they're getting a more and more diverse population. They find that they're going to be just riven with class conflict. All of the things that they didn't desire will come into being. And in fact, for most Americans, their standard of living and their well-being declines. For most Americans, this is not an American story. They don't want to hear about this. It's best to just skip from Reconstruction, and then we'll land in Progressive, and then the real American history takes over again.
One of the things that's really striking about this book is the absence of kind of great men political figure heroes. And I think that that plays into exactly what you're talking about there, that instead of there being these kind of towering figures where even if you don't like the things that they do, like Andrew Jackson is a pretty ambivalent figure at this point in American history, you can still cast him as hero or anti-hero. But there's no single political figure in this period that you can in any reasonable way give that kind of agency to.
There's no age of Benjamin Harrison. And what you end up with is it becomes, you know, as I tell my students, it's the sort of golden age of facial hair, that you have these presidents who all look sort of the same and you can't remember anything any of them particularly did. And it is a period of weak presidencies. And I came to have a little more admiration for them. They're not as stupid as they seemed, as they're often portrayed, but neither do they dominate the age. So this is not an age of towering political figures. And then what makes it even worse is it's the age in between Abraham Lincoln, who is a towering figure, and Theodore Roosevelt, whether you like him or not, who is another towering figure. And in between, you know, you seem to have the seven dwarfs.
I love that phrase, both the seven dwarfs and the golden age of facial hair, because, like, you know, nobody is out here, like, proclaiming their fandom for Chester Arthur.
That's right. That's right.
Like, there are no real Chester Arthur heads out there or Benjamin Harrison heads or Grover Cleveland heads either. That's, yeah, they don't have fan clubs in the present day. Even Calvin Coolidge has fan clubs.
Yeah, though he's a very strange man. He's our only cross-dressing president, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not a period that gives you a lot of those figures to latch onto. And, I mean, in the sense of kind of the structures of political power that we're dealing with here, is it just that it's more diffuse, it's more concentrated in Congress, and the presidency is rendered weaker by that?
Its power is concentrated in Congress, but the critical thing is after the election of 1876, it's not only powers in Congress, but Congress is pretty evenly divided. There's only going to be a few years in which one party will control all three branches of government. And in each case, it turns out to be the worst thing that ever happened to them. They pass policies which immediately wreck their own agenda, and the next Congress swings back again. So it's a bitterly divided nation, closely matched in Congress, and whenever one side can push forward its agenda and manages to offend enough people, that the next election is a disaster for them.
It's hard not to see parallels with the present day in that regard, where just you have strongly partisan political parties, because they're not necessarily ideological political parties, but they are strong. But there are really strong partisan loyalties.
Yeah, and I think the difference from today is that the strong partisan loyalties are, even though the ideology can be a little diffuse, there are clear ideological divisions between Republicans and Democrats. And in the 19th century, Republicans and Democrats each had strong wings, an anti-monopoly wing that's strong in each one, a sort of regular wing, which is an establishment wing, and liberal in the 19th century sense of small government, laissez-faire. And those people are represented in each party. So you can have people cross partisan divides to vote on the same bill, but their loyalty is a loyalty of identity. There's an identity politics in the 19th century as strong or stronger than today, which really determines whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
It's one of the things that I found both kind of disturbing and comforting when drawing parallels to the present day and thinking about your book, the fact that partisanship was so strong and has been for much of American history. And so when we today look at the rise of strong partisanship once again as this kind of like quasi-apocalyptic thing sometimes, with reasons both better and worse, but like the looking back at the last period of weak partisanship, that's the outlier, yeah, not the strong partisanship. Yeah.
I mean, it's very hard when you grow up in a period to not think that's typical of all of American history. And the thing is that partisanship has been very, very dominant through much of American history. There's been places of weak partisanship, just as there's been times where America has not been an immigrant nation. But most of the time, it has been an immigrant nation. But the problem is you grow up in a period that becomes your normal. And you think, in fact, the changes are switching back in a way America never was before. But sometimes it's going back very similar to the way it was for a very long time.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. As I said, it's kind of both disturbing and comforting almost, yeah, to know that that there are some cyclical things that are happening here. I want to come back really quick to the idea of political parties, to the concept of political parties and how they functioned here. Because one of the central themes of this period and of this book is the failure of the promise of the Civil War. And part of the reason for that, which you point out at great length here, is ideological divide within the Republican Party between those who were really committed to equality before the law, equality of opportunity, to a homogenous citizenship, and those who had other priorities, namely, you mentioned small government and free markets. So how does the conflict between those two play out in a broader sense?
Yeah. What had happened with the Republican Party is that slavery had united it. The opposition to slavery defines the Republican Party before the Civil War. Once you've defeated slavery, then these other fissures will attempt to come out. It had been a party that was formed out of a union of old Whigs and old, what I call, well, not just me, but we're liberals, small L liberals. Liberals were the great enemy of slavery. Liberalism, which said that it wanted independence, it wanted what they called self-ownership, it was against institutions such as the Catholic Church or established religion, it was against a government that would, in fact, allow slavery to exist. Liberalism was a huge weapon against slavery. But when slavery vanishes, liberalism doesn't really have a place to go. It begins to worry about a government which is now acting to uproot the last vestiges of slavery and the society created. They're against that kind of government power. A government which is for redevelopment like the Whigs wanted, they're against that too. They begin to worry about corruption in the Grant administration, which is quite real, but they don't pay much attention to other issues. Meanwhile, you had a set of abolitionists who were sometimes liberals and sometimes not. And those abolitionists, again, split apart. Some of them think once we've gotten slavery, once we've freed the slaves, that's it. There's nothing else that has to be done. They tend to go over to the liberal side. Others, like Thaddeus Stevens, no, our work has just begun here. We really need a whole reorientation of American society, which is going to demand an active intrusion by the government, including the use of military force. And other Republicans pull back from that. So what you're having is a fissure within the Republican Party about how far to go. And it's going to finally culminate in the breakaway of the liberals, the Greeley campaign in 1868, which will be a disaster for the liberals. But it also shows this weakness in the Republican Party. And then when the Depression of 1873 comes and the Democrats come back into power, Reconstruction is really at that point doomed.
It's striking how fast that happened.
Yeah.
The promise of Reconstruction was ended almost before it began.
Well, the promise remains, people will try for it. But the thing is it called for something that Americans were hesitant to do. It was called for the steady application of force against a recalcitrant population. Now, Americans are willing to do that if, in fact, that population is non-white. Indians can be as recalcitrant as they want. They are going to have force come down on them. As it will turn out with black people, force will come down on them too. But that's one of the ways in which whiteness still matters. There's going to be a hesitation to use that kind of force, particularly in the South, even though organizations like the Klan are unleashing incredible force in the service of terrorism. So there is that kind of reluctance to really engage as fully as you might. They'll do it sporadically. And in fact, the history of it shows that, in fact, force works. The Klan can be suppressed, but it's got to be constant. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the really striking things about this book and about the Reconstruction era in general, is the extent to which violence really is omnipresent, especially in Reconstruction. It's not like the violence ends when the Civil War ends, and it keeps going and going and going and going. And the reimposition of white supremacy in the South after the Civil War is a series of violent altercations. I mean, there are hundreds of people killed in some of these clashes.
There are. And in fact, in elections, let's just ones in Mississippi, there can be up to 1,000 people killed, more than 1,000 people killed. These are fighting in the streets kinds of things. And it's going to be not only that, but you couple that with the Indian Wars in the West, you couple that with pogroms against the Chinese, and then just the constant labor strife in the 1870s and 1880s. This is a very violent nation. The United States did not settle these disputes peacefully. And again, we have this imaginary view that once, in fact, this is how neighbors settled things and it was only the intrusion of the government. That's not the way the United States worked.
That's especially striking when it comes to the story of the American West, which is a major part of this book. It's striking how much the story of the West has changed, even in my lifetime, that it's gone from being, you know, a heroic one of triumphal settlers heading off into an unpopulated land to one a lot more focus on the dispossession and horrible treatment of Native Americans. I mean, so how was that, which does not involve a huge percentage of the population, demographically speaking, how is that connected to these broader developments?
Well, the major developments connected with is it's one of the things that has begun to puzzle me is why does the United States expand so quickly into the West? Because what we find is that not that many people settle in the West, and it's not, in fact, that the West is critical to the American economy at the time. California is, but mostly it goes around the railroads. What the railroads do, and the railroads are subsidized by the federal government, is they intrude on Indian country and they disrupt the economy of particularly the Plains tribes. They threaten all of it. The railroads precipitate the wars. The railroads bring in white settlers, not in huge numbers, but enough that they have to be protected. So the development of an industrial capitalism, which goes around railroads, is one of the critical things for the Indian Wars. Then the question is, well, why? What if we'd never built the railroads? Or what if we built them more slowly? I think, in fact, that we've given Indian peoples a longer time to adjust. Eventually, Americans are going to come. But it came so quickly in such overwhelming force and with such violence that it seems to me as a policy decision, it was just bad, particularly when Americans often flow into these arid lands and flow right back out of them. A place like Nevada, when the railroad comes through, it's actually going to lose population once mining goes down. There's large parts of the West which lose population very, very rapidly. So it seems to me one of the great policy mistakes of the 19th century, the subsidies to the transcontinental.
So this is something that you've written about at great length in your previous book, Railroaded, which, again, I highly recommend to the listeners. It's one of my dad's favorite books on 19th century American history, and he's a man with taste. Why was that decision made so quickly? How did to build the transcontinentals and to subsidize them so heavily? How was that sausage made?
Well, it's the Civil War. I mean, in so much of American history, the answer is the Civil War. The Civil War, when they get those bills through, there is a danger that California is going to leave the Union. And there is a danger that, in fact, the Confederates, there's large Confederate sympathy in Southern California. And so the idea is we have to link it to the Union. We need the gold to come back over here, though you don't really need a railroad to get the gold there because they got the gold without the railroad. But it's for the Union. That's what justifies it. But they don't start building it until the Civil War is really finished. And after that, they've already funded other competing railroads. So you can make a reasonable case that you need one railroad, but you don't need five, six, or seven. But once the bills are there, once there's money to be made, once the corruption begins to kick in, then the railroads are off and going. And they're going to go bankrupt. They're going to fail repeatedly. They're going to be an economic disaster. But the rationale, and the strongest rationale they ever had, is it's necessary to hold the union together. And that's what brings the first transcontinental.
So the argument that they're what binds the union, together. I mean, true of kind of transportation, communications, technology throughout history. Is that more of a literal fact, or is it kind of an ideological statement?
By the time it goes through, it's more of an ideological statement, because for much of the West, there's no people there. It's relatively few people. It's big territories and big states with relatively small populations. And the odd thing is, in California, which is the vital part of the Western economy, most goods continue to move by water. Railroads are necessary, but they funnel things into San Francisco. Then they get on ships. Then they come across Panama. Then they go into the eastern United States. Or they go across the Pacific. That's the cheapest way to move goods. You can move people more quickly by this, but there's not that much transportation that's necessary to go back and forth, and one railroad would have done it. So it's I think, more going to be ideological than any economic necessity. These railroads, transcontinentals, are not profitable until really the 1890s.
That's one of the things that you point to repeatedly, is how, A, unprofitable they were kind of at a basic level, but B, poorly run, C, poorly designed, and dependent on continuous infusions of cash in what, in a lot of cases, amounted to basically a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these railroads are capital intensive. They have to be able to borrow money constantly. And the money's constantly being funneled out by insiders into their own pockets. So anytime that the financial markets tighten up and you can't get loans, they go bankrupt. And when they go bankrupt, because they've become so powerful in the economy collapses. And so that's why this whole period is a place of constant, what they called in the 19th century, panics or busts, which we just called depressions and recessions.
The ripple effects are really interesting, because as a total percentage, I've had arguments with economic historians in the past about where they'll say, well, but this thing was not an especially large part of the economy in terms of a percentage of GDP. Like, the, you know, this sector is much more important. This other sector is much more important, namely about slavery, about mm-hmm. slavery's importance to the economy. You really see it there, where they're like, well, but this is only 6% of the economy or 10% of the economy in this period. Transcontinentals were not an enormous part of the economy as a percentage of GDP. But they were enormously important in terms of the ripple effects and how they concentrated capital and how they sucked in money from other sectors and precisely who was invested in them.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with transcontinentals is they're connected to everything. A transcontinental will be connected to Eastern railroads. When a transcontinental goes under, it's going to affect the other railroads too. And the railroads, particularly by the 1870s, 1880s, are buying each other's bonds. When these things begin to fail, there's a ripple effect. The banks who have loaned the money start calling in loans. And so they are incredibly important. To say that they're not a certain percentage of the economy ignores the linkages in the economy. And the linkages are very, very strong. And every time there is going to be trouble in the railroads, we are going to go into a deep recession or depression. 1873, the early 1880s, the 1890s, 19th century, they called them railroad depressions, and that's exactly what they were.
One of the things I've enjoyed about both Railroaded and the Republic for which it stands is how it turns the portrait of kind of towering businessmen of this era on its head, where it is much less about the kind of heroic concept of a, you know, this towering figure with a great innovative idea, and through hard work and sweat, they build up their business until it's this colossus. You really point to the importance of other factors in the rise of the just staggering fortunes of the Gilded Age.
I mean, somebody like Andrew Carnegie. Carnegie comes up through what in the 19th century they call pull. I mean, he's connected with Tom Scott in the Pennsylvania, and his early career and his early money is all going to be made by his connections with the Pennsylvania Railroad, with insider information and with the kinds of connections that he has. Steel industry, he's the first one to admit, without the tariff, he is a dead man. The tariff allows him to compete against British steel. Otherwise, he could not do it. And when, in fact, he's going to be in trouble with his own workers, he's going to call in the state of Pennsylvania to subdue them. Andrew Carnegie is a political creature. He depends on government to get what he has and is recognized at the time. It's why he becomes such a hated man for much of the 1880s and 1890s. And you can say the same thing for others. that John D. Rockefeller is in many ways, you know, a financial genius. I mean, he's a very strange man, but he's certainly a very successful man. But he never thinks that his business can break away from government. It needs government. It needs government enough that he gets in so much trouble in Pennsylvania that he's under indictment and can never even enter the state. But Rockefeller himself has this kind of individualism, this kind of competition. He says, no, that's not what this economy is about. That's what academic enthusiasts, what he means academic economists think. This is not about competition. It's about what he calls cooperation, which we call monopoly, with controlling everything that he possibly can about the oil business.
You pointed, when you were talking about Andrew Carnegie, to the use of state force to suppress his workforce. And that's kind of a recurring theme across this entire era, is when labor tries to organize and it tries to carve out something more for itself, the ways in which large businessmen with their networks of friends were able to turn the force of the state against their workers repeatedly, over and over and over again.
And this is something which, again, will evolve over the period, because one of the things workers realize is the fate of a strike is ultimately going to be political. And what workers can do is, in local communities, they can control the sheriff, they can control things. So what the corporations constantly try to do is to push things up to a higher level, to push it to the state. And very often it's going to be the states that will intervene and bring in the militia. But very often, as in the Pullman strike, the state of Illinois does not want to intervene there. So then you have to bring in the federal government. Now, the danger is the federal government is, by a law that everybody tends to ignore, but it was quite important, the Posse Comitatus Act, is prohibited from actually intervening in these kinds of civil endeavors, except in very, very, very civil disturbances, except in very specific instances. And one of them is the failure to move the United States mail. So the Pullman strike revolves around the railroads manipulating the route of railroad cars to put a mail car in every single passenger train, which will get them to have federal troops come in and intervene. So the whole thing is to allow federal troops to come in to intervene in a strike, and they crush the strike. So over and over again, there's going to be this kind of subterfuge in the end to bring in federal troops if you can't get state troops to do it. But I would argue that virtually every major strike is going to be, in the end, a political strike, and it's which side can muster the political support of government, whether local, state, or federal, is going to decide the outcome.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths, and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
This comes back to something that we talked about earlier. This is how this is not a happy period. And so many of these stories, whether it's the Native Americans or the labor movement in this period, or kind of even just the general decline in living standards, environmental degradation, are at least the seeds of something better born in this era?
Yeah, the seeds of something are there. One of the things that, oddly enough, both anti-monopolists and John D. Rockefeller will have in common is this idea that individualism is dead, that individualism might have described an earlier version of American society, but it certainly is not describing the society of the late 19th century. And that the word that shows up over and over again is cooperation. People will attach different meanings to it. But by 1896, when you have this bitter election between William McKinley and William Jennings Bryan, which appears that they're miles apart, when you look at them in hindsight, they're actually fairly close together. Both of them agree that from now on in American society and the American economy, the federal government is going to have to play a critical role, that this is a society which has become too diverse, too divisive, and too large to simply be allowed to careen out of control. So by 1896, we're going to quarrel about a whole bunch of things, but it's not going to be the role of the federal government. It's not going to be the idea that you can have just unlimited competition. Laissez-faire is a meaningless concept by 1896. And so what you're going to get in after 1896 is this merger of the old anti-monopolist trends, which were present in both parties, with the idea of the older Whigs and others who begin to think that, you know, a more bureaucratic United States is probably in order, and you're going to get the birth of progressivism. So just when things look like they're at their worst, you're really at the point of the birth of a new United States, a very different United States than the one that exists in the late 19th century, but whose roots, whose basic ideas are still present in that society.
Those looking for some comfort, I think suppose could find some right there. I want to ask kind of on a technical level. This is an enormous book. It covers so many different things. It covers, I can't list them all here. Like it's a jam-packed period, and you hit on everything at some point or another. On a practical level, how do you do that? Like, how do you write a book like this?
Well, one of the things I do is I start looking for uniting themes, and you've identified what they are. I mean, home is going to be a critical one. Corruption is going to be a critical one. The changing role of government is going to be a critical one. So one of the things, I find the theme. The other thing is I had to find a narrator. I had to find somebody who would lead me through it. And there I luckily stumbled on William Dean Howells, who I had not read very much since I was in college. And Howells turns out to be a person who knows everybody, who's not a politician but is involved in politics, who's an astute cultural observer, and whose own family is suffering through many of the crises of the Gilded Age. So Howells' letters and Howells' books can serve as a sort of narrator, somebody who can be my Greek chorus, who will lead me through all of these things. The other one is just to read very, very widely. And then there's also that I did cut. I mean, one of the things that is for people who are not academics, there's a kind of academic review which everybody expects and they know they're going to get, which is, you left out this and this and this. Why didn't you mention so and so and so and so? Well, then my answer usually is, this book is way too long to begin with. Can you imagine? So some things really are going to be downplayed. I have to see what I think are the major themes. And you can agree with me or disagree with me, and we can argue about it. But there is no history of the United States that can take in everything. In the end, time will tell whether I hit the major themes or not. But it is a challenge. It's a challenge to write this kind of narrative history. And I chose my themes and I carried those themes through, and I took them in part because they could include so much and because they did bring in the whole country. There can be a tendency in these books to write an American history which is really about the northeastern United States, and that becomes the real America. But the South gets to play a cameo in the Civil War, but then after it fades away. And I try to keep the whole country in play during the whole book.
I mean, you really succeed in doing that. This definitely gave me a broader view, not just of this period, but of kind of the diversity of America as a whole, as it more or less has always been. It definitely succeeded in doing that. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. So what drew you to this period in the first place?
What drew me to it is I knew it from doing the railroad book. And the railroad book came out of the idea that much of the settlement of the West seemed to have this giant hole in it, that how did the West become so corporate from the very beginning? How did it come to depend on government and corporations much more than individuals? So I was interested in the Gilded Age for that reason. And then I teach a 19th century American history course, and I began to realize that, you know, the 19th century was just flyover country, that, you know, people teach history in college, they do reconstructions, I say they jump from there to the progressives. And I begin to realize the Gilded Age is really much like today. I mean, you tick off the themes: immigration, corruption, dysfunctional politics, vast industrial change, the growth of inequality, which disturbs a great many people over and over again, a whole series of themes which are resonant today really were resonant then. And that got me to thinking about the period. And I thought, well, 100 years from now, people can look back at our period and think, well, what do you have? What changed here? There's no great political movement we can think of. There was just this endless strife that was going back and forth. There's certainly a lot of change going on, but there's no coherence to it. You know, nobody's going to call my generation the greatest generation. There's none of this stuff going on. But then I thought, well, if you take that, you're probably missing an awful lot about us, what a vital time this is for American history. And by analogy, you're missing it about the Gilded Age. So I thought, well, what is critical about the Gilded Age? What happens when a country really has to struggle with transformational change? What happens when a country really has to struggle with the whole image they have of the country becoming very, very different during their lifetime? What happens when people have a vision of the country that they want to achieve and they fail at that vision? And that those are compelling themes, and that got me deeply interested in the Gilded Age.
It's funny, and I'll say this as we kind of draw to a close, how centering those questions and those themes and this period as opposed to the one that precedes it or the one that follows it changes your perception of the arc of American history as a whole. It gives you a much different picture of what's important and what matters and how things change over time.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, because the reason people leave out the Gilded Age is because they can't make sense of it in the usual American narrative. But get used to it. It was real. It was 40 years, 40 important years of American history. And just because you can't fit it into the narrative that comforts you doesn't mean it's not important. And it probably should challenge the narrative that comforts you. That,
I can think of no better summation of the whole thing. Professor White, thank you so much for your time and joining me. I cannot recommend this book highly enough. It is a long read, but I guarantee you, if you read it or you listen to it on Audible, it will change the way that you think about American history for the better.
So, thank you, Patrick.
Thank you. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show and send us your questions at Tides History. Thank you again to Richard White for joining me, and you can find his book, one of my and soon to be my dad's favorites, I just got him a copy, wherever books are sold. We'll also put a link in the show notes. From Wondery, Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Episodes are engineered by Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. The executive producer is Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.